The question tonight is, how might a God accept me? How might a God accept me? So thanks, Paul, very much.
I remember my my sixth form prom. There was a girl, we'll call her Claire, because that actually was her name. And she was a pretty good friend of mine throughout my sixth form. She sang in the same choir as I did. She went to the Christian Union. And we had a really good evening that night at my sixth form prom. Eventually the music faded, the lights came up, and I plucked up the courage to suggest to her that we ought to see each other again. She said two words to me. Goodbye, Paul. Ouch, that really hurt. That really, really hurt. Now, I don't tell you that story in order to make you feel sorry for me, but I think that you should do. But I guess we all have similar kinds of stories, don't we? Similar stories of some kind of rejection. Whether it's a girl or a boy, a university, a job interview, a sports team, a friendship group, we all know the experience of rejection. And we all know that it hurts. It really hurts. Did you know that clever people have done experiments to show that actually physical pain is not as bad as the emotional pain of being rejected, not needed, not wanted, put on the edge? Rejection hurts. Which actually means that we spend a lot of time thinking about how to be accepted. I kind of guess there are two ways to avoid rejection. The first is to avoid people. But then you discover that actually you're rejecting everybody else, which is kind of a bit defeating the object. Or, alternatively, you make yourself more acceptable. There are plenty of wiki pages out there to tell you how to do it. Whether it's smiling more, better posture, working out more regularly, thinking about nice things, all those things will make you more acceptable to others. Did you ever feel or do those kind of things as well when you were younger, or think that way? If I do something, then it will make me more acceptable. Maybe I dressed like the people, you dressed like the people you admired, you listened to the same kind of music, you took up similar hobbies, all to fit in or be accepted, conforming. I guess we've probably all done that in one way, shape or form. And probably when we look at the photos of our childhood, it leads to quite a lot of embarrassment. Rejection hurts. We want to be accepted by others. Why? Well, I think it's because relationships matter. Relationships are important to us, and the Bible explains it by showing that relationships are important to God. God makes people in his image to enjoy relationships. You see, let's face it, if you think about the world and everything around us, relationships are so important that wouldn't it be a bit weird if we discovered that the God who made it all doesn't think that way? Isn't himself relational? If there was a personal God then who's responsible for making the world, then wouldn't it actually make sense if that personal God wanted to relate to the world he'd made? That kind of makes sense to me. And it makes more sense than a God who made everything but is actually distant from creation, because relationships are so important. So, if God has made people to relate to him, if there is a God who is personal, then the question is, what might that God think of me? What might that God think of you? Will that God reject me? Or will he accept me? And how do I know? Now, the interesting thing is that almost every God throughout the history of the world, both in time and also across the world spatially, have something in common. Whether it's Greek mythological gods or sun gods or religious gods or modern secular gods, they all tend to have the similar values. You'll receive blessing, acceptance, all that God has to offer in some kind of payback for the sacrifices that you make. That's the consensus of the world. The harder you work in serving your God, the more likely you are to be accepted by that God. That's what a wiki will tell you. And it might be that that's the way that you're instinctively thinking this evening too. I don't know whether you have a specific God in mind as such. You might not. But think about the thing you crave most. What you'll probably discover is that your actions are responsible for trying to make sure that you receive that thing. Now, Jesus said something which was recorded in John's account of his life. It's in John chapter 10. Jesus said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly." Basically, Jesus is saying that he is totally different to any other religious character in the whole of history. That he is the one who is the key to bringing abundant life rather than destructive death. You see, all religions will tell you to work harder to make yourself acceptable to God. But if that is your mindset, if that's what you're told, you will die trying. Never having got to the point where you'll actually live up to the standard of a perfect God. It's crushing. It's destructive. Or imagine a parent always saying to their child, "You've got to work harder. You've got to keep pulling your socks up. You've got to do better. You've got to sort yourself out, and then I might accept you." It doesn't sound like the way we want things to work. Doesn't that sound actually like the way that teachers and education and that kind of thing tends to work often? That kind of mindset smacks of human wisdom to me. I wonder if we've started to create gods in our own image. Do this and we'll accept you. Who wants a God who has an initiation rite to get into his clique? Don't you think that maybe if there is a God, he might do it in a way that we don't expect? That if there is a God, that he might have a different wisdom to our wisdom? That he doesn't work according to human ways? Well, Christianity is actually unique in this regard because Jesus stands in stark contrast. He doesn't say all those things about working harder. He says he is the door. He is the way to salvation. He is the way to be accepted by God. He invites us, if you like, to knock on God's front door and we can come in. We can be accepted by God and live life to the full. Why? Because Jesus is God. God in a body, come to live amongst his creation, to reveal himself to creation. None of us are good enough to know God. None of us can earn our way to him. We deserve to be rejected by God, but in Jesus, God offers relationship with him. And he does it in the most surprising way. Jesus says this straight after that last bit that I read. "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Jesus dies the destructive death for our imperfections. And he rises to abundant life to bring us to God. You see, Jesus does not tell us to sort ourselves out to become acceptable to God. He accepts us as we are. Imperfect, sinful. If you like, he takes us with him as his plus one to be restored to that relationship to God. This is the Christian God. And he doesn't work like imperfect, sinful people, keeping us out of his club. No, he welcomes anyone who asks to come in. Now, this might all start sounding a little bit too good to be true. But there is a warning here, a warning. Jesus accepts you as you are, but he won't leave you as you are. The more time I spend with people, the more their influence rubs up on me in my thinking, in my habits, in my hopes and joys. You see it in marriage is often the husband and wife end up looking similar and wearing the same kind of clothes and thinking the same way. Well, in the same way, the more time you spend knowing God, the God of the Bible, the more you'll start thinking like him, the more loving and welcoming you'll become, the more you'll want to become like him. And actually, that's the abundant life, I think, that Jesus is talking about. Life as it was always intended to be. So the question is, I guess, where does this leave us all? I reckon we're probably all in one of three camps. And if you're not, then ask me a question about it. But I reckon we're probably all in probably one of three camps. The first one is this. You don't want this to be true. You don't want this to be true because you instinctively think that being a good person is the best way to appease any God because it feels right. As if being accepted by God is like being accepted for a job or passing an exam, so that that way you can feel a sense of achievement and you can look at others and think, well, I've passed, but have they? But just because you want your way of thinking to be true doesn't mean that it is. Have you perhaps, I want to say this in the nicest way, have you perhaps fallen into the trap of creating a God in your own image who has standards slightly lower than yours? You know, just because, as I say, just because you want your way of thinking to be true doesn't mean it is. If trusting Jesus is true, is the only way to know God, then surely it's worth spending a little bit of time finding out about it. Checking it out just in case. So maybe come along to something like this. There's flyers on your table introducing Jesus. A chance to find out more about who Jesus is. Secondly, you might think this is all totally irrelevant. You might be thinking, so what? Okay. Well, I want to ask you this as nicely as I possibly can. Why are you here? Why are you here if actually it's all irrelevant? Because I think that probably deep down you're here because you don't think it's irrelevant. Or maybe you're on a journey discovering and finding out more. And for whatever reason, you've ended up, I would say, in the right place. Keep listening, keep thinking, perhaps pick up one of these, John's Gospels, to think and to find out more. Because as you read John's Gospel, you will discover that there is nobody who says that Christianity or that Jesus is irrelevant. As C.S. Lewis said, Christianity, if false, is of no importance. And if true, of infinite importance. The only thing it cannot be is moderately important. And then thirdly and finally, what if you find yourself this evening desperately wanting what I've said to be true? Well, maybe this evening Jesus is asking you and encouraging you to trust him. In which case, then chat to me, chat to Tim, chat to somebody that you've come along with to find out more. Read more of John's Gospel and find out more about Jesus. And I can assure you that it will be the way to abundant life. Well, thank you for listening.
Great. Let me introduce you to the other members of the panel this evening. There's Paul, whom we've already met, and sat next to Paul is Fee. How would I describe Fee? Fee is a book loving, especially Nigella Lawson cookery books, so your son says. Piano playing, regular running, women's ministry team leader here at Christchurch Central. You're married to Chris and got a son, Sam. And sat next to Fee is David. And David's a consultant pediatrician. He's a food-loving person. I know that very much indeed. His daughters say he's funny. He's a very bad liar. And he's not very and he's not very good at telling people off. Is that right, Lydia? I wish my kids could say that about me. My kids are frightened of me. why does God allow people to suffer? David.
Okay, it's difficult to answer this question. And I can give you some biblical answers to this. And beyond it, I'm always thinking, why is somebody asking me this question? And it's the big one, because people ask this question because by its very nature, suffering hurts. And it hurts in different ways. and there may be nothing good in it. So I'd like to know why the person's asking it, but it's something we all ask at times. I would love to not have a job. Surprises my family, and my wife looks terrified. If there was no suffering, you wouldn't need a doctor. And I see that many situations, particularly that end in death, where I can say, this is not good. How can a good God who has all power allow really bad things to happen? And I sometimes see them happen and happen and happen. So it's a real issue. And if it's a real God, there has to be a real answer. And what I do know is he promises it will come to an end. The mystery is, why hasn't it come to an end? And the Bible's answer is, because when he sorts it out, he sorts it out root and branch. And we can't escape that, because we are part of the problem. And I know Stephen Fry has got an issue with a God who allows bone cancer in children. But there is a God who is going to ban all suffering and every cause of suffering. So as long as you've never lied, as long as you've never cheated or made people think you're better than you are, you've got a chance to stand before him. But if you've ever lied, even a little white lie, we all have a problem. Because when he sorts out suffering, he sorts out every evil act, no matter how gentle and how calm that act is. May not like it, but that is a Christian response.
David, thank you very much indeed. One of the other questions, and I come to you with this, Paul, one of the other questions is, can I do anything at all to be right with God? I mean, just carrying on from what David was saying just a moment ago.
Yeah, thank you. That's a helpful question. I kind of want to link it to, actually, back to the suffering question as well, because the answer is yes and no. The answer is no, in that, as David said, when God deals with suffering, then actually, as those who have caused suffering, what's he going to do with us? If we want God to get rid of suffering, what's he going to do with each of us who causes it? So there's that element to it. But the main thing I want to get to is the fact that I think, again, Christianity is unique, because we believe in a God who's not above suffering, a God who doesn't tell us just to get over it, but actually a God in Jesus who has experienced suffering and experienced the greatest suffering that anybody could suffer, in terms of rejection of people, rejection from God himself, and physical suffering which led to death. There is nothing we can go through which Jesus hasn't gone through. And why did Jesus go through that? Well, he went through it so that God didn't have to do those things ultimately to us who cause suffering to others. So can we be right with God? Yes, we can be right with God because Jesus experienced the suffering that we deserve. What can we do to be right with God? We can say sorry to him, and we can trust Jesus that he has done what we should have experienced to be right with God.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, David. Just to change the subject, moving on to another question, come to you, Fee, with this. First, why do certain people understand about God and God things, and others don't seem to understand or get it?
That's a good question, isn't it? You know, do you have a certain disposition towards believing in God and others not? There's all sorts of factors in that, aren't there? There's our upbringing. There's our experience. There's a whole mixture of things. But I think, you know, the Bible's really clear that anyone can become friends with God. And he is there and waiting for people to come to him. So what holds you back? Well, the Bible, again, has this word, sin. which is where we rebel against God. We want our own things. We want to do our things our own way. And of course, you know, when I want my own way, then I don't want to think about anybody else's way, and not God's way. So sin separates us from God, and that puts a barrier between us and him. But as we've just been hearing, Jesus went to the cross and paid the price for sin so that we could become friends with God. And he is known as the friend of sinners for that reason.
Thanks, Fee. There are three questions now which are similar. They're in the same ballpark. So I'll ask all three questions and then come to each of you really for your comments and your thoughts. Are other religions simply less attractive or actually false? Are they not just another path to a different heaven? So that's the first question is about are other religions simply less attractive or are they actually false? And Paul, you did highlight what Jesus said himself, is that he is the door, the only door, and he said any other way, basically, or anyone who presents another way is a thief or a robber. It's quite a strong thing to say of other religions and other religious leaders, so we throw that into the melting pot as well. How can we really be sure if it's true, if anything's true? That's a related subject. So those three questions there. What about other religions? Are they simply just less attractive, or are we saying they're false? Jesus said they're false in the part of the gospel that you were reading and sharing with us, Paul. How do we know whether anything's true or what is true? We've got to make a judgment somehow. I've lengthened how I'm asking the question so that you've had plenty of time to think. Who wants to go first?
Do you want me to go first?
Brave man, good on you.
Well, I guess I've done a bit more thinking just along these lines because of the passage. The thing that really struck me as it probably came through, is the way that Christianity and the Lord Jesus himself stands pretty much as a complete contrast to any other religious leader, religious person in the entirety of history and in the entirety of space. Because he is the one person who plausibly, and there have been others, but plausibly came and said, I am God, and had a long-term, broad following of people. Other people have said it, but Jesus, I think, stands alone in regard to the way in which people have followed him. And his way of getting to know God stands in complete contrast to every other religion, whether that's Islam, whether it is some sort of Roman mythology, which we look back on in history and think that was just all a bit bonkers, wasn't it? They all work on the same premise. Work harder and God will be pleased with you, or God might be pleased with you. And so I think because the two are so contradictory, Jesus is probably legitimate in saying, look, I am the one who will take you to life. But you, if you keep on trying your own way with your human wisdom, will only find death and disappointment and destruction. And so the two cannot both be true. The question is, am I going to trust Jesus or am I going to trust myself?
Thanks, Paul. Let's come to you next.
So it sounds quite an arrogant claim, doesn't it? But actually, it's on the lips of Jesus himself. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one can come to the Father except through me. Those are his own words. So if we're going to be offended by the Christian message, then we're offended with Jesus. And surely, if we want to have a God who is going to care for us, love us, give us the best that we could possibly have in our lives and in the life to come, we'd want him to be true. And, you know, we wouldn't mess around looking at anything else. So, for me, I put my life in Jesus' hands, because he's said he's the way, the truth and the life.
Thank you. David?
In many ways, I find other religions much more appealing because you have a ready audience. People naturally understand if I work harder, do more, then I'll get more. Whether your God is no God and you're an atheist, or whether your God is money because you're a capitalist, or whether you have a named proper religion, it's all quite easy to understand. The Christian message, I think, only makes sense if you start to crack the assumption that the rationalists put forward today, and that is, how can it be true? Because people don't rise from the dead. When you start to look at the evidence and it starts to suggest, because it probably did happen, you start to see, well, there is more than just a bit of sense to the Christian message. So I think the Christian message is compelling and different, but it happens to just be true. And we don't have the time, and I don't think I'm necessarily the right person to argue it. But it's true because it's true, because it's based on real events in history. Not every Christian is an intellectual infirm. And you have to go and look at what the evidence says.
Dave, thank you very much, and thank you to all three of you. I've got two questions here now, before the last couple of questions. These ones are about judgment. And why, if God will accept anyone, are some people judged by God and others not? So why, if God will accept anyone, are some people judged by God and others not? Then the next question, if God can't stand sin, how does he accept people with a sinful lifestyle? And the questioner has put here, e.g. homosexuals. Okay. All right. So two questions there about God's judgment and lifestyle and what is sin. Who should we come to first? Ladies first? Yeah, why not? Fee.
Can you just repeat the question, Tim? Sorry. Is that the first one?
Pick him up again. Yeah, so the first question is, why, if God will accept anyone, are some people judged by him? So the statement is, the presumption in the question is, God accepts anyone, but some people, why does he not accept others? And then the other one was, if God can't stand sin, how does he accept people with a sinful lifestyle?
Okay, I'll go for the first one at the moment. Why does he accept some and not others? Again, it comes back to this, you know, what do we do for God? Does he accept me on the basis of something that I've done? And does that mean that something I've done is special or pleased him in some way that someone else hasn't done? And that makes me better in his eyes, so he'll accept me and he won't accept the other person. But that's coming back to this, the doing thing that Paul was explaining about earlier. Because it's not on the basis that you've done. That's why Jesus is so different. Because if he accepted me for what I'd done, what I'm trying to say is he doesn't accept me for what I've done. Because I'm a sinner. I rebel against him. And I have rebelled against him, and I will rebel against him. You know, even though I'm a Christian, I still have sin in me. I still rebel against him. So it's not on the basis of anything that I've done. It's all on what Jesus has done. And that is the real crucial difference. So for anyone who's a Christian in this room, who's accepted Jesus as the price for their sin, that says he went to the cross for me and he's made it possible for me now to be the Bible says, a son or a daughter of God. It's not on the basis of comparison, because we're all sinners. The Bible says we're all sinners. We've all fallen from God's glory. We all fall short of him. So it's always on the basis of what Christ has done. So, as a Christian, I am accepted by God, and I have assurance of that because of what Christ has done. Not because I'm a better person. I'm not. I am a hopeful sinner, rather than a hopeless sinner because of Christ.
Fee, thank you very much indeed. David, let's come to you next with that question.
I think all of us are in the same boat when it comes to who God accepts and who he doesn't. And there's two things. Everybody's invited. Everybody's accepted. But the way to destruction is broad and the way to salvation is narrow. And the truth is, many people will not accept the free offer. And God's kindness to us doesn't run out because we do bad things. There's always a way back for someone who looks to him. So the idea that God accepts some people and others because perhaps somebody's done something worse. I mean, the church is full of people who have done terrible things, including mass murderers, including swindlers. And to name one particular sin above the other, for God, they're all the same. So I think the assumptions in the question are wrong. There isn't a graduation in sin. All is the same, and all can be equally covered over. And we don't stop sinning just because we believe, but we do start changing the moment we believe, and we become free from that.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. I'm going to move to the final couple of questions here, because time is moving on. Go on, one thing.
Okay. Why are some people judged and not others? Is in some respects, it's a question which is all about, do we trust Jesus? And so I just want to turn that question back on us all and say, will God judge us, or are we trusting Jesus?
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. What do you mean by abundant life, Paul?
Life as it was always meant to be lived. Life knowing God, life enjoying God, life delighting in all the stuff that God has given us. And actually being, like David was just saying, being changed to become more like God.
Thank you. Final question. What if I believe there is a God but don't do anything about it? That's the final question. Let's have a comment from each of you. Who wants to go first? Just jump on in. What if I believe there's a God and I don't do anything about it? Fee, you're moving towards the microphone. You wanted to go first?
A verse from the Bible just came to my mind. Today is the day of salvation. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart. That means today is your opportunity. Don't waste it. Because you don't know what tomorrow will bring. And I don't want to be morbid, but we don't know when the end of our life will come. So today is the day. Take the opportunity.
Thanks, Fee. Paul?
It's just worth qualifying and clarifying something really brief. Belief in a God makes no difference. I think all of us believe in a God. But actually the question is, do you believe that Jesus is who he says he is, who he is God? And if you believe that Jesus is God, then please, please, please don't do nothing about it. Because that would be the worst decision of your life. Because you've come to a realization of something which is true. And if you do nothing about it, you act as if it's not true. Which is just, yeah, it's just crazy.
Thank you. David.
You may not realize you have to do something. You have to do something. If you come to the end and there is a God who says, now you understood how much it cost me to bring you into heaven. It cost me my son. Yet you got to the point and you decided it wasn't worth taking a step further and associating yourself with me and my church. Now that is an ultimate act. Ultimately, it's an act of cowardice. And God does ask that from you. Make yourself known.
OK. Give him a round of applause. Thank you very much indeed, Luther. Thank you. Thank you. It is a very vulnerable thing to sit on a high stool like this and face questions which they basically didn't see beforehand. I did as I shuffled the deck and put them into some sort of order. So we really appreciate what they've done this evening and the folks last night and the night before. I just get the easy job of reading the questions. You might want to find out more. You'll see some details of what's happening on Sunday, the 15th of March, this coming Sunday, at our church, at Christchurch Central, which is, we meet on Sundays in the workstation, which is right next door to the showroom cinema. And times and the themes of what's happening on Sunday are there on that little leaflet. So I'd encourage you perhaps to come this coming Sunday. And two other ways which you might want to follow through on engaging with the things that you've heard this evening. One is to pick up a copy of John's Gospel. If you've never or haven't read for a while a portion of the scripture, there are four accounts of Jesus' life, his death, his resurrection, called the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. John's Gospel, there are copies next to the green plants over there, next to the slightly greeny grey pillar. Please do pick up one of those. They're a gift to you. Take it and read it at home. And if you want to find out a little bit more about what is in John's Gospel and you want to carry on asking questions about it, then you can come along to this 5-week course, Introducing Jesus. It's going to be happening at my own home with my wife, Tanya, who is sat just over there. We'll provide some puddings and there'll be a lot of opportunity for you to ask your questions, to discuss things. We won't ask you to sing or to pray or to read out loud or anything like that. We'll do our best to make sure you feel at home with us and that you have a chance to engage with Jesus more effectively in that kind of a way. So the dates of that are on that leaflet as well. Please let me know if that's something you're serious about coming to, and we can make sure we're ready to welcome you. I think that's it for the evening. Thanks again ever so much to the folks who've been on the panel here. Thanks to Dunk, who's going to come back and just sing two or three songs for us before we have to clear up and be out of here. Thank you very much indeed.